as international airports, which has also led to a high rate of death among people with chronic diseases. Patients can't receive basic drugs such as insulin for diabetics, and this is a tragedy no one talks about.
The ministry says almost 169,000 patients cannot receive life-saving medicine and they are in real danger unless the siege is lifted.
The pharmaceutical system in Yemen has been gripped by the Saudi blockade. International companies have partially or completely left the Yemeni market as they face extra costs as well as seizure of vessels for weeks and months. Moreover, medicines should be delivered in special conditions to maintain their quality and effectiveness. The fuel crisis has also negatively affected the shipment of medication.
Earlier, the member of the National Negotiating Delegation, Abdul Malik Al-Ajri, accused Western powers of preventing the entry of medical supplies into Yemen, saying this precedent has never been witnessed throughout history.
Officials believe that Saudi Arabia is deliberately preventing medical supplies from entering Yemen to pressure Sana'a to accept the UN agreement as it is. They say the siege has failed throughout 7 years of the war, and the kingdom's measures will push the Yemeni army to carry out new air strikes. عبد اللطيف الوشلي صنع.
Days after going to the polls, the United States remains in electoral limbo. Dozens of elections for the House of Representatives still remain undecided, while control of the Senate is also up in the air as two narrow races are still counting their votes. Just like in 2020, multiple battleground states have had controversial outages of their voting machines and surveillance equipment, leading to more questions by candidates and voters about the integrity of America's elections.
It speaks volumes, and we see these problems happening everywhere. If you ask me, a very common sense solution is to stop using all this technology to vote, because technology is easily hackable. None of it's secure, despite what anyone wants to say.
Projections show that Republicans will take the House, while the Senate will likely come down to a runoff vote next month. Democrats are trying to spin the idea that they could have lost worse as a positive outcome, but without definite results, political life is on hold with major consequences.
Going back to George Bush's own first election over Al Gore, you saw that it was in Florida, where George Bush's brother was the governor, that the ballots took forever to be counted in. So all of this technology, the oligarchy that we have even in America, these problems are not limited to the third or the second world. They're right here in America.
President Joe Biden indicated he will run for re-election, even though a recent poll showed that 72% of the United States doesn't want him to run, and that includes 56% of Democrats. Ex-President Donald Trump continues to separate himself from the mainstream Republican leadership, as he's expected to announce next week that he's running in 2024, refusing to wait until after the crucial Georgia Senate runoff vote next month. The latest inflation numbers barely edge downwards, meaning that the average American is now suffering from both economic and political instability. Mass layoffs, which had been delayed until after the election, have already started, as the world keeps moving forward, even if America's electoral results do not. Ramin Mazahiri, Chicago.
The EU's executive arm, the European Commission, suggests the bloc's economy will have contracted for a six-month period up to the end of March 2023. This means recession. Inflation is forecast to stay high for longer than initially anticipated. Uncertainty surrounds the medium to long-term picture also.
The largest threat comes from adverse developments on the gas market and the risk of shortages, especially not this winter but next winter.
As EU energy sanctions against Russia appear to backfire, business and consumer confidence continues to decline across the 27-country bloc.
We're very concerned, particularly for people that are on lower incomes that are very much affected by the higher energy prices.
I'm afraid that it can get much worse before it gets better.
The price of the energy is so high, the price of the products, I think it's a thing of everything.
EU leaders firmly blame Moscow for the crisis amid the conflict in Ukraine. However, some commentators claim the United States has used NATO to manufacture the war.
America is fighting against multilateral world, but basically is fighting against our freedoms, our democracy, and everything it pretends it stands for.
The EU says it will continue to fund the Ukrainian army and government no matter what the cost. Back home, the only good news is that employment figures remain positive. Just modest damage to the EU labour market is forecast for 2023. It is an area that is being monitored very closely by the Commission, as there's broad consensus. A sharp rise in unemployment would represent the final nail in the coffin for the EU economy. Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
Diplomatic tension between Italy and France keeps mounting as the French NGO-run search and rescue ship Ocean Viking reached the French port of Toulon with its load of 234 asylum seekers on Friday. The ship had been refused a port of safety by Italy's far-right government for around 3 weeks, a decision that the French government slammed as irresponsible and inhumane. In response to the situation, Paris suspended plans to take in 3,500 refugees currently in Italy, calling on all the countries in the EU's migrant relocation mechanism to adopt similar measures.
È la prima nave.
The Ocean Viking, NGO ship that docks in France today, is the first NGO ship to have ever docked in France, and it has 234 migrants. This generated a very tough reaction with respect to Italy, which has allowed almost 90,000 immigrants to enter since the start of the year. 90,000! All NGO ships dock in Italy. What makes us angry? That Italy has to be the only country to provide a disembarkation port. This is not written in any agreement. France's response was aggressive and unjustified.
A third of the 234 asylum seekers on board the NGO ship will be relocated in France, while four passengers with serious health difficulties were transferred to a French hospital. This is not the first diplomatic rift between Italy and France in recent years. In 2019, Paris recalled its ambassador to Rome for consultations, after then Foreign Minister Luigi Di Maio urged members of the Yellow Vest movement to continue with a protest against the French government.
There is a clear resemblance between the rift that took place in 2019 and the present one. Both cases are just a mere provocation on the part of nationalist, populist Italian executives. This tension between Italy and France is the result of the insubstantiality of the EU's migration policy.
While EU countries keep failing to collectively assume responsibility on the migrant issue, around 20,000 asylum seekers have died trying to cross the Mediterranean Sea since 2014, while tens of thousands are stuck in Libyan detention centres where torture, sexual violence and abuse are rife. Max Civili, Rome.
Walthamstow, a town in East London, home to more than 150,000 people and the longest outdoor market in Europe.
It also happens to be one of the poorest areas, where a national cost of living crisis is pushing more and more people to the brink. And less money in people's pockets has meant less business for the shops and stalls here.
Couple that with soaring utility bills and increased prices that make running a successful business a real challenge.
My weekly sale is like half and half now, this time especially. For example, I'm earning about a weekly 1,000. For example, it's go 5. It's half and half now. And the people are scary. They don't spend much. They are very choosy now.
Quiet, very quiet. We see the market empty. Because we have people, but like pass, just on the pass. Nobody edition because they don't have money. But rent now high. But energy right now very, very high. Gas high. And because that expensive right now.
The cost of living crisis has fed into the housing market as well, forcing Anne, who works in a coffee shop, to move house.
A couple months ago, I was living in a house share, but the landlord got really, like, worried about the cost of living, and he, like, tried so hard to, like, increase the prices little by little, and we ended up, like, having an argument about it, and he ended up, like, evicting me because, like, I didn't think it was fair, but he was forcing us to do stuff. So now, like, I'm paying, like, a really high price for, like, such a small room, no, like, living room or anything.
More than 6,000 people in this area claim universal credit. Recent surveys have found that nearly half of the children here live in poverty. Desperate parents and households are having to rely on charities such as this one to get by. We were told the Roxana Khan Foundation Food Bank gives donations to an increasing 300 households every week. Inflation remains stubbornly in the double digits, and the government has hinted at increased taxes and cuts to public spending. Many here and across the UK will find it even more difficult to make ends meet. Saeed Puriza, Walthamstow, East London.
A recent study published in the Indian Journal of Ophthalmology reveals that a large number of those who sustained eye injuries due to the use of pellet guns in the mainstay of Srinagar between July and November 2016 have suffered some degree of vision loss. The survey conducted on 777 eye operations during the period reveals 80% of the victims have vision limited to counting fingers. 35-year-old Arshid Ahmed, a student of arts, was hit by pellets in both eyes in October 2016. 6 years on, Arshid says his vision of higher studies diminished just like his eyesight.
Initially, I thought things might get better after the operation, but as time passed, it started to get worse. The most hurtful thing for me is that I am dependent. I feel I'm a burden. How long will my family be able to support me?
Arshid's family was more fearful than hesitant to talk, and convincing Arshid to speak to Press TV about his condition was no less than a Herculean task.
I'm often confined to my room. Darkness is my future, although the government has bragged about rehabilitation and support for pellet victims. We're left to helplessness and nothing else, and speaking about my helplessness has now become a crime.
Before the abrogation of Kashmir's special status in 2019, New Delhi used shotguns for almost a decade to quell anti-India demonstrations in Indian-administered Kashmir, resulting in thousands of pellet injuries and the epidemic of vision loss in the region. Following the abrogation of Kashmir's special status in August 2019, people here might be upset about many things changing in the region. However, a remarkable achievement for government forces is that not even a single pellet gun has been used in the region following a tough crackdown on protesters. Kashmir has been a bone of contention between India and Pakistan for decades. Both lay claims to the region but rule it in parts. India regards Kashmir as an integral part of its territory. Meanwhile, analysts say since the abrogation of Kashmir's special status, New Delhi seems to own everything in Kashmir except the problems of its people. Shahana Bhatt, Indian-administered Kashmir.
The largest ever joint U.S.-South Korea Air Force drills extended into last weekend as North Korea launched more missiles. Pyongyang argues U.S.-led military exercises revived this year are a rehearsal for invasion. Amid reports North Korea may conduct a seventh nuclear test, U.S. officials warned Pyongyang the use of nuclear weapons would end its regime. In South Korea Thursday night, university peace activists gathered for a vigil outside the U.S. embassy, calling for an end to the U.S.-South Korea-Japan alliance and removal of President Yoon. The U.S. has also conducted renewed joint drills with Japan, including a naval fleet review as Tokyo seeks to normalize its military activities.
North Korea faces much stronger conventional forces in the U.S.-South Korea alliance, which is at least partly why it showcases its missile and nuclear deterrence. With the U.S., South Korea, and Japan all bolstering their weapons and military drills, the questions are if and when North Korea will conduct a seventh nuclear test. Frank Smith, Seoul.
This is IRIB English Radio. Website is www.parstoday.com/en.
Supplication on Wednesdays. In the name of Allah, the All-Merciful, the All-Compassionate. Praise belongs to Allah, who appointed the night to be a garment, and sleep for a rest, and day he appointed for a rising. To thee belongs praise, for thou roused me from my sleep. And hadst thou willed, thou wouldst have made it everlasting, an everlasting praise that will never be cut off, and whose number the creatures will never count. O Allah, to thee belongs praise, for thou created, then proportioned, and ordained and decreed, and gave death and bestowed life, and made sick and healed, and made well and afflicted, and sat upon the throne and encompassed the kingdom. I supplicate thee with the supplication of one whose mediation is weak, whose stratagems have been cut off, whose term has drawn near, whose expectation from this world has shrunk, whose neediness for thy mercy has intensified, whose remorse for his neglect has become great, whose slips and stumbles have become many, and whose repentance is devoted sincerely to thy face. So bless Muhammad, the seal of the prophets, and his household, the good, the pure, and provide me with the intercessions of Muhammad, Allah bless him and his household, and deprive me not of his companionship. Surely thou art the most merciful of the merciful. O Allah, Decree for me on Wednesday four things. Induce me to be strong in obedience to Thee, to be joyful in worshiping Thee, to be desirous of Thy reward, and to abstain from that which would make incumbent upon me Thy painful punishment. Thou art gentle to whom Thou wilt.
Now from Ontario, Canada.
Now back to our story.
What is it in there?
We will be talking about this.
Let me bring in Leo Sazdi. He's a professor of international.
The Spotlight.
When it comes to the relations between the U.S. and China, the number one and two economies in the world, it is set to be the worst in decades. During the G20 summit, when the two met, U.S. President Joe Biden warned President Xi Jinping on a host of issues like North Korea and Taiwan. Can the two manage their differences to prevent competition from becoming conflict, as the IMF has warned? Or is it inevitable that the two are on a collision course? Just a couple of the questions we'll be asking in this edition of The Spotlight. First, let me introduce our guests for this edition of the program. Daniel Lazar, journalist and author, joins us from New York. Also joining us is Mahmoud Rafat. He's the president at the European Institute for International Law, who joins us from Stockholm.
This is The Spotlight. The Spotlight takes an in-depth look at the headlines, featuring interviews with well-known guests from diverse backgrounds to get to the bottom of the story. You can listen to The Spotlight every day on IRIB English Radio.
Gentlemen, welcome to you both. Daniel Lazar, I will first start with you, taking a look at the relations between the U.S. and China. I've broken it down into some of the core issues that seems to be the ones that they are experiencing major differences in. We're talking about Hong Kong, for example, or Taiwan, the South China Sea, trade practices, and U.S. restrictions on Chinese technology. Is it accurate to say that those are the top, four or five issues that they have major differences on?
Yes, and you could also throw in Xinjiang and Tibet as well, where the U.S. has backed various kinds of pro-independence forces. But sure, those are the key issues.
Okay, so setting that stage, Mahmoud Rafat, what are we looking at when it comes to an issue like North Korea, when the U.S. President Joe Biden actually issued a warning to Xi Jinping, the Chinese president, that it would enhance the security positions in Asia, that was the warning, if Beijing cannot rein in North Korea's weapons program. I mean, doesn't that, in a sense, imply that China can pull the strings when it comes to North Korea and its weapons program?
Well, let's say United States doesn't treat one level in China. China is a full package. Which has economic interest from one side, represented in the cheap labor, represented in the big markets more than 1.5 billions, etc. But at the same time, it has thrones to the United States, and it has some difficulties in the United States, some challenges, like Taiwan level, like North Korean level. That's why it takes it, or it should be taken as a package from any administration, this administration or another administration. Maybe the unique exception was the President Trump administration.
And okay,
President
so when Trump you say it has to be taken as a package, you mean that North Korea then is part of a package when it comes to China?
It's a part of the Chinese package because it represents a real and serious and critical challenge to threat, I mean, to the United States. And so this is the most.
So when North Korea fires its missiles, is it doing on its own or is it taking orders from China, do you think?
Well, China has big harmony, if we can say it like that, with North Korea. That's sure. It has a strong relationship since a long time, since decades, since the father of actual president, not only from today. So it has a warm and somehow upper hand, if we can call it like that, mm-hmm. in the decisive situations, it can stop North Korean threats to
United States. With that? Do you agree with that, Daniel Azar, that China has that much influence over North Korea to the point that it can just tell North Korea, stop your missile test? Or are we looking at the fact that, in the U.S.'s point of view, at least that's what the U.S. president is saying. He said, he issued a warning. That's how it was reported. Stop North Korea's weapons program. I mean, does China have that much influence?
No, I think the U.S. exaggerates China's influence over North Korea. I mean, yes, China has had basically, strong relations with North Korea since over the last 70 years. But North Korea itself is a very independent-minded country. Doesn't take orders from Beijing or anyone else. So therefore, I think China has influence, but that influence is less than decisive. I think the U.S. is being very aggressive in accusing China of somehow being responsible for North Korea's missile program. And, of course, that can't help but raise hackles on the part of the Chinese.
Very curious as to why Mahmoud Rafat, since we're talking about North Korea, and then we're going to move on from that, why they don't talk about U.S. sanctions. I mean, U.S. sanctions are killing North Koreans, literally. They don't have much trade going on, and you can tell by the state of, I'm not too sure what sector it's not affecting. I mean, why isn't that mentioned when you issue a threat when it comes to U.S. To China on the North Korea issue?
Well, before I go to the sanctions, because unfortunately these sanctions killed also Iraqi people in the past, not in the very long past, let me just clarify something very important. When I say China has big influence on North Korea is to break down its threat to the United States, not to stop completely its missiles program, because that's impossible, because this is the unique legitimacy for the regime there, as well as the unique protection for North Korea, according to the thinking or way of thinking of the North Korean regime. So not the program, but about the threat itself. Well, concerning sanctions, let me say to you, because I'm author of book, can be found on Google, Economic Sanctions Between International Law and Practice. Unfortunately, the practice of applying and application of sanctions and economic sanctions is violating severely the international law, and that we have been witnessing in lots of cases in Iraq and somehow in Yemen as well. They, by the coalition of Saudi Arabia and United Arab Emirates, backed by UK and United States, and that's literally harvesting lives of Yemeni Tigray by the regime of Abiy Ahmed, which is backed also by the West, etc. So there is big violation in the international law for economic sanctions, not only North Korean.
Sure.
Unfortunately, it's like that.
Okay. Now, moving on to Taiwan, pretty clear where the stance is there from both, I think, Daniel Azar, when you have China saying that that's a red line, and then the U.S., they have done what they've done, whether it's military supplies, whether it's sending high-ranking officials there, And Xi has been very clear. And let me see if I can pull out a quote here where he has said, anyone that seeks to split Taiwan from China will be violating the fundamental interests of the Chinese nation, and ultimately saying that it's a red line. How can there be any kind of resolve there? The Chinese stance is clear. We know what the U.S. thinks. And also at the same time, let it be known, or we should bring into the conversation, that Joe Biden, even though they said that they've cleared up the issue, has said on numerous occasions now, we can say, that it will come to defend Taiwan were it to be attacked militarily. So, you know, if you can clarify that for us.
Yeah, Joe Biden has vowed to defend Taiwan militarily on at least four different occasions. So that's pretty strong. America is the global hegemon. It is the most powerful country on earth, and it also has gotten used to running global affairs according to its own interests. And so the U.S. sees the rise of a powerful China, which is in a position to challenge U.S. hegemony, as really a kind of life and death issue. So the U.S. is determined to put China in its place. And that means taking a very strong stance on Taiwan and navigation of the South China Sea, and also engaging in militarily ever more confrontational policies. What this leads to is impossible to predict, but it seems that a military clash of some kind seems to be ultimately unavoidable. We can't say when, we can't say how, no one knows the answer. But in a case like this, it seems the U.S. will do whatever it has in its power to put China in its place. And I think that essentially requires, from a U.S. point of view, a Russian solution. In other words, just as the demise of the Soviet Union led to the rise of Boris Yeltsin in the 1990s and a full decade of economic ruin for Russia, I think that what the U.S. ultimately wants is a similar denouements, a similar chain of events for China, in which the Chinese communist power is overthrown, a pro-capitalist government is installed, that will undoubtedly be followed by years of decay, corruption, economic setbacks, et cetera, et cetera. But the U.S. essentially wants to cut China down to size.
Okay, well, they have a number of issues that perhaps they can get to that, if you agree, Mahmoud Rafat. We talked about North Korea. We briefly talked about Taiwan, which is one of the major issues at this point. Because of lack of time, we have to move on to the other issues. So I'm going to go and ask you about the trade practices that the U.S. has raised with Beijing. It was done under the former U.S. president and many other ones before that, where they have... in this case, in point, labeled it as non-market economic practices. What are China's non-market economic practices that the U.S. is talking about?
Well, the biggest problem of United States with China on this level or on this scope, I think it's resumed by the former president of, former director of CIA at the time of President Trump. When he wrote an article, I remember, in Washington Post, if I remember, or New York Times, and he detailed the essential problems with China on the trade level. Chinese are accused by Americans. They steal the developed technology of Americans and the West in general, but American in particular, and then they resell it for cheap prices. That's why there are big loss for American companies. Number two, stealing this technology as threatening or big threat to the United States in general, not only on the economic level, but also on the national security level. And that's the big concern of the conservative side of the American politician. While the Democratic side, they are not so much scared of China in this level. In my opinion, mm-hmm. this is a reason to Americans to be scared of because that represents a real threat to their national security, not only to their economy, because the economy, the United States, well, still the pressure, okay, of the U.S. dollar.
Let's try to get an idea about, because you used the word steal there, Ahmed Rafat, and I'm wondering, Daniel Lazar, what the deal is when it comes to the technology aspect that that word is used. Because, correct me if I'm wrong, but in order for major corporations, companies, or businesses from the U.S. to have access to the Chinese market, one of the prerequisites is that they need to share that technology. In exchange, they will have access to that huge market that China offers them, hence equals profits for them. Or is that not true? Because if it's sharing, then it can't be called stealing.
Yeah. No, I think you're correct. I mean, I think that, the, of course, disputes break out, as they inevitably do, in which the U.S. accuses China of actually, you know, misappropriating technology in a way that is contrary to the rules. And China very well, you know, may be guilty at times of that, just as the U.S. is guilty at other times. It's worth bearing in mind that the global market is structured in America's favor, so a rising young power like China really has to fight an uphill battle against U.S. hegemony. But there's my colleague referred to two areas of friction in terms of U.S. economic policy. But there's a third area, which is actually in many ways more important, and it's extremely ironic that the U.S. accuses China of using its socialist industrial policy in a way to allocate investment, resources, et cetera, in a way that is unfair to the Americans. In other words, the Americans blame Chinese socialism because it's too effective in terms of global economic competition. That's extremely ironic, because the America always insisted that socialism was actually inefficient and was ruining
the U.S. says it likes competition, though. Isn't that what Biden said? We'd like the competition. So,
Of course. But everyone likes competition as long as they're winning. And no one likes competition when they're losing. And so the U.S., you know, which is desperate to safeguard its international position, dislikes competition when it tends to undermine American hegemony.
Well, that's the whole thing, isn't it? Mahmoud Rafat, isn't that the whole point here? I mean, we may laugh about that, but when the U.S. can't, I mean, I'm sorry to say, but the U.S. can't get its way, even if it invites competition, then it goes about it, with what occurred just recently, right before that big conference where Xi Jinping, I guess, grip on power got extended, the U.S. Dropped the hammer, the chip technology, in which it restricted that technology to China. And it said the goal was to actually prevent China from it, because chips are used in so many different arenas, but one of the biggest ones, to prevent China from militarily advancing. And also, it would undermine China's ability to import or manufacture and export the semiconductors that run the world. So it goes and it actually does that. Is that called fair competition?
Well, let me call attention of my dear colleague, Daniel. This socialism, and let me start from there. This socialism, policies in China, which assure and guarantee for the American industry the cheap labor, and makes the huge structures like Apple and other structures like that, Tesla, etc., are functioning properly, because in the United States or here in Europe, we would not be able to afford the labor of these people, because there is no the Chinese socialism. I'm not defending on any policy. I'm just focusing on and putting the light on something. Well, back to this question. Let me tell you, the chips is the main point, is the real point. Whatever, in any direction we will go through, it will not be the real direction if we do not take in consideration the chips when it comes to Taiwan. Without the chips, and without the big industry chips, which is the biggest in the world, Now, and the big experience, etc. Despite it's a big chain of supplies, but at the end, this chain of supplies from the chips are gathered or centralized inside Taiwan. So this is the importance of Taiwan. Otherwise, Taiwan would not have that importance to the United States. Which would not have, because, well, if we go to the practical area and we lay the slogans of democracy, of supporting democracy, of supporting rights of people, of independence, etc., because all these speech we discover last 30 or 40 decades are slogans. And the real time, the American administration is administration who's handling a nation. They have their own interests. They need their own interests. That's why they give back to any other consideration. Look how they are supporting dictator regimes of the Middle East today, and they are protecting them and feeding them, and not
good
only protecting
there.
Them.
Sure, yeah. that's
a
good point.
It's not a question of slogans. It's the chips. It's the chips. The chips is the main key word of all the story with Taiwan.
Indeed. Now, you know, we talk about all the differences at this point. Daniel Lazar, I began this program with some of the core issues, which you agreed. And then we come to this revelation, which I would think it should be like major headline news, where it says the U.S. is working to reduce tensions behind the scenes, both Beijing and Washington, over the past, and this is what is an eye-opener, 2 months. 2 months to repair relations. So go figure. I mean, they're working behind the scenes. So I don't get it. So you have Nancy Pelosi and a whole host of other, not hosts, but a number of high-ranking U.S. officials or lawmakers that were visiting Taiwan. You have the tensions that are going on. You have the provocations, etc. But yet in the past 2 months, they've been working behind the scenes to mend relations. How do you read that news?
I'm very skeptical. I mean, I think sure. Biden doesn't want a military, conflict. He wants to keep things under control. He wants to make sure that communications go back and forth. But still, the U.S. posture is a very hard-line one. The U.S. essentially is trying to roll back Chinese power, to extend American clout, into Chinese territorial waters. And listen, the big prize will occur in Russia, which if the war in the Ukraine continues to go badly for Moscow, Vladimir Putin could conceivably fall from power, and if that happens, all of Central Asia will be in play, and the U.S. will use that in order to apply pressure on China from China's west. So the U.S. essentially will be in a position to squeeze China from both sides, from the Pacific side and from the Central Asian side. This is the great game that various U.S. foreign policy theorists have outlined over the years. It's the ultimate U.S. goal. And essentially the goal is to squeeze China until China finally breaks.
Mm-hmm. Well, to use the Russia chip, how likely do you think, Mahmoud Rafat, that is going to happen? And, for the U.S. to, militarily, to try to defeat through, of course, Zelensky and its military, Russia, in order to wean Russia away, or China away from Russia, in order to have that split occur. I mean, is that realistic, do you think?
Well, in my opinion, United States will not enter in any confrontation for the coming decade. I mean, military confrontation, neither with the Russian side nor with the Chinese side, in my opinion. And that was resumed by the former chief of the CIA in one of his, the former chief of CIA, the former chief of the army, the general of the staff of the army, which was leaked that he warned his Chinese counterpart last few days of the mandate of President Trump, when he said to his Chinese counterpart, if we are ordered by President Trump to hit you at any time, I will let you know before we do that, and we will do our best to throw our missiles in empty areas.
Okay.
That means the military officials, which I want to go through, this military officials in the United States and strategic thinkers of the United States are very, very aware that the United States is not in the position today, after what happened in the Middle East last two decades, is not in the position, and Afghanistan for sure, last year, not in the position at all to enter in any military confrontation against anyone. Today, the Russian situation is too early because we do not know who is the winner.
I'm so sorry, I got to jump in because we're fresh out of time, Mahmoud Rafat. I do apologize. I wish we had more time on this, but thank you very much. That was Mahmoud Rafat, president of the European Institute for International Law, and Daniel Azar, thank you so much, journalist and author from New York. With that, we come to an end of this edition of The Spotlight. From Mikhail Batapoy and the team, it's goodbye.
Iranian Radio, Global Mission. This is IRIB English Radio. Log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
ایمان را در خودتون تقویت بکنید، ایمانی که هم در اینجا شما را شرافتمند می کند و هم در پیشگاه حق آبرو دارید و با آبرومندی وارد می شید به تخت اعلی.
In the path of the Imam.
In the name of God, salam and welcome to the program. If you remember, we said that Imam Khomeini returned to Tehran from the holy city of Qom after 10 months due to his health conditions. Today we are going to discuss the events related to the outbreak of the 8-year war which was imposed by the U.S. through its stooge, Saddam Hussein, the former dictator of Iraq. Stay tuned for more. After a few months of adventurism on the borderlines, the Ba'athist regime of Saddam in Baghdad started the military invasion of Iran on September 22, 1980. The war began with the bombardment of Iran's airports. Saddam hoped that the Islamic Republic of Iran could not resist the invasion and would soon collapse. The fact of the matter is that the eight-year war was imposed on Iran due to the fear of the U.S. and its allies from the spread of the Islamic Revolution to other Islamic countries. As Saddam was dreaming of leadership of the Arab world, he managed to unite almost all of the Arab regimes in one front against the threat of the non-Arab Iran. Thus, on September 22, 1980, Saddam ordered that 192 bombers and fighters should target Iran's major airports. In the afternoon, the Iraqi Air Force attacked the airports of Mehrabad in Tehran, Nojeh in Hamedan, and the airports of Tabriz, Sanandaj, Isfahan, Kermanshah, and some other cities. Simultaneously, the Iraqi ground force started invading Iran's soil on three fronts with three corps. Although the Iranian people were first feared of the Saddam attacks, in many of the border areas, people spontaneously hindered the advancement of the Iraqi army with little equipment and ammunition. Meanwhile, many of these people were forced to leave their homes and hearths. Moreover, the Islamic Republic Air Force shot down five Iraqi aircrafts on the first day of the invasion. Imam Khomeini's representative in the army, Ayatollah Sayyid Ali Khamenei, announced on TV, "The hired and mercenary Iraqi government has started the aerial invasion of the Islamic Republic of Iran's border and attacked several air bases. We had not intended to attack so far, but the Islamic Republic army does not tolerate the invasion of these Ba'athist stooges and will give a bitter lesson to Saddam." The Iranian Air Force attacked the Iraqi bases of Ar-Rashid and Shu'aibiyah of Iraq just 2 hours after the Iraqi invasion. The next day, the Iranian brave pilots targeted the air bases and communication and radar centers of the Iraqi Air Force with 140 bombers. Iran continued crushing air raids for another 2 days, which forced the Ba'athist army to transfer many of its aircrafts to Al-Walid Air Base near the Jordanian border to be out of the range of the Iranian fighters. However, the Iranian reconnaissance aircrafts chased them, and the Iranian pilots successfully operated the aerial fueling and reached Al-Walid Air Base to destroy many Iraqi fighters and bombers. The operation was called H-3 and was registered as an honor in the history of the Iranian army. Although the Iraqi invasion was a shock to the Iranian nation and government, they were soon united behind Imam Khomeini and stiffly resisted the Iraqi criminal army with high morale. The officials in those days all spoke of the Imam's firm belief and his certainty of victory over Saddam and his invading army. On the first day of the war, Imam Khomeini said about Saddam's invasion, "Nothing has happened. Just a crazy man has thrown a stone." This showed his strong faith in God and godly promises. At the same time, he humiliated Saddam. Elsewhere in his remarks, the founder of the Islamic Republic of Iran said, "We will resist, even if this war continues for 20 years. In those tough conditions, Imam Khomeini was so calm, as if nothing had happened. The Imam's wife, Ms. Khadija Saghafi, said, "I really hate war, and I am worried that how many dear ones will be lost. But I believe in the leadership of the Imam,
I am sure that he will keep the country safe against the evil of Saddam. You too, don't worry. Imam Khomeini issued a message to the Iranian nation at 7 o'clock that day. In the message, the Imam asked the people to resist steadfastly against the Iraqi invasion.
Comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. IRIB English Radio.